Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Russian Empire History Podcast, the history of all the people of the Russian Empire. I'm your host, JP Bristow, and this is Season 1, The Forest, The Steppe, and The Birth of the Russian Empire, Episode 35, Imaginary Khazars Part 3, New Khazaria. Before we begin, I'd like to thank new patron Olga, who listened to the entire podcast so far in about 5 days and left a comment on each episode, and to all the new subscribers on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And once again, my great thanks to Tsar Muhammad for his continuing support. Apologies for another delay. I did plan to put this out a week ago, but I had a cold and lost my voice. And once again, I'd just like to note that this episode contains discussion of anti-Semitism and references to material that some listeners may find offensive. We talked last time about Lev Gumilyov, a man who some see as a great scholar to rival Kant or Marx, who saw his life's key work as building an elaborate, and to me, completely mad, theory of ethnic origins, which contained a comprehensive restatement of the Khazar myth as the hodgepodge of theories concerning the Jewishness of the Khazars and their enduring adverse influence on the world as usually known. It was Gumilyov's scholarly stature that made his work particularly pernicious. It was taken as an academically legitimizing framework for nationalist and anti-Semitic myth-making and conspiracy theories, a scientific endorsement of a worldview in which the exceptionalism of certain nations was a fact, a simple realization of natural phenomena, and where shadowy forces lurking behind the scenes were not merely rivals but unnatural, anti-human, and evil. From the underground of the 1980s and 90s to the mainstream today, these ideas have grown and mutated, keeping the central idea of the Khazars as the enemies of Russia, or indeed the Slavs generally, the true force behind every enemy in the last 1,000 years, out there plotting the Slavs' defeat and planning to build new Khazaria in place of Russia, or more recently, Ukraine. And that is what we're going to look at today. Gumilyov himself did not consider Sviatoslav's destruction of Khazaria to be the end of the Jewish chimera. Deprived of their base, the Judeo-Khazar elite, he wrote, scattered across Europe, looking for new opportunities to create discord and find their way back to power. Gumilyov saw Khazars behind Mr. Slav of Chernihiv attempting to seize Kyiv in 1024, and believed that his army was made up of Tatars. He claimed that they followed their usual plan of using intermarriage to attempt to come to power in Kyiv itself, entering into a struggle with Orthodox priests who refused to solemnize the mixed marriages. This process was only brought to a close by Vladimir Monomakh expelling the Jews from Kyiv in 1113. With this done, Russia returned to the normal course of its ethnogenetic development. However, that was not the end of it. By the 19th century, Russia was entering the breakdown phase of development, and the dissipation of its passionary charge gave the old chimera the chance to return to the fray. In this view of history, it was no simple accident that so many revolutionaries were from a Jewish background. Gumilyov saw Vladimir Lenin and Felix Dzerzhinsky as leaders of a Jewish force driving the Bolsheviks, who destroyed Russia. The ancient Khazarian desire to subjugate Russia was realized in the 20th century with the creation of Soviet Khazaria, where the old Judeo-Khazarian merchant elite was transformed into Jewish commissars. The crimes of the Bolsheviks, the suppression of Orthodoxy, the prison camps, the artificial famines, therefore became Jewish actions against the Russian people. However, like other nationalists, Gumilyov had a complex relationship with the Soviet idea. While attacking the supposedly Jewish-dominated early decades, he was more approving of the ethnic Russian-dominated post-war period and despised dissidents and the pro-Western position. Like other nationalists, he deeply desired to be part of something big and strong, so the Soviet Union attracted him as much as it repulsed him. The Cold War fitted into his conception of a Russian super-ethnos across Eurasia, which was being opposed by the European and Chinese super-ethnies, who wished to deny Russia its own part of development. Despite mistakes made by the Soviet Union, he believed that it was capable of playing the role of uniting Eurasia under the leadership of Russia. He even found a reason to say that Stalin was not all bad, claiming that the doctor's affair, when Stalin launched a campaign against the Jews, was the one thing he did right. It was not mere chance, he thought, that Stalin was dead just a couple of months later. The Chimera would not just give up. As we get into the reception of Gumilyov's work, I think it's worth noting that his enormous popularity was mostly among the wider public. Historians were generally not among his fans, and he himself was disparaging about history and considered himself more of a scientist. You will probably have noted in the last episode that his telling of the history of the Khazars and Rus was largely incompatible with the one we have heard during this podcast. It's fair to say that his version of the relations between Russia and the Mongols is also hard to reconcile with known historical fact. Actual historians have called his work sci-fi novels, a muddled mix of quasi-science and patriotism, called him a myth-maker masquerading as a national scientist, and stated that theories such as the ethnosphere and passionarnost cannot exist as objects of theory. He's been criticized for knowing nothing of and taking no interest in economics and for systematically avoiding facts when building his narratives, with his presentation of Khazars being one instance of this. What Gumilyov called his natural science method meant theories about ethnicity and the ethnos as the subject of history. All history consisted of wars, rivalry, and alliances between ethnies. Questions like, when did the Rus arrive in Kiev, or did Rurik really exist, were of no importance or interest to him. Take the idea of behavioral stereotypes we talked about in the last episode. Do you think that Gumilyov actually studied early childhood upbringing and how it relates to identity? Of course not. He probably would not even have had any ideas where to start, as that kind of subject was well outside of any of his fields of expertise, and his indifference to work by Soviet ethnographers has been noted by many of his critics. Where he might have been on firmer ground in the relationship between the environment and peoples living in a given place, he was equally indifferent to exploring how or if this theory actually worked in the real world. Just cast your mind back to the first episode or think of a map of Russia or the Soviet Union. How could Russians possibly be described as living in a single environment that determines their ethnic adaptation? The people he picked as exemplars of passionarnost, like Alexander the Great or Napoleon, didn't create any new ethnies, but scholars have seen them as something else, passionary elites versus non-passionary plebs, and seen the idea as parallel to ideas about the collective unconsciousness and idealists circulating among European fascists in the 20s and 30s. Viktor Schnirelman, a Russian historian and ethnographer who studies nationalism and anti-Semitism in the post-Soviet space, wrote that Gumilyov was not the father of ethnology, as his followers sometimes like to call him, but, quote, the prophet of dilettantes and xenophobic half-educated people, the kind of people who are filled with a furious desire to provide humanity with a new version of universal history. He probably did not intend this, but the fact is that Gumilev, in essence, prepared the ground for authors of pseudo-historical gibberish, and the demand for their writings among readers. Gumilev somehow became an authority and sanctioned a willful attitude towards history. Today, anyone can do anything they want with history. They can turn over facts to suit their ethnic leanings. They can cite no facts at all. They can invent evidence where it does not exist. His self-elected followers, who are completely without his intuition, his erudition, or his poetic gift, are creating a fantastic caricature of his ideas, parasitical on his many-sided personality. End quote. We are, of course, years away from reaching the Soviet Union in this podcast, so let's just briefly outline some of the important factors creating the environment in which Gumilev's work arrived. The Soviet Union had had its own ethnic project, dating back to the earliest days of Marxism. Socialism would require and engender a new socialist human identity, and with time this became the Novy Sovietsky Chelovek, the new Soviet person. The vision of what this meant changed over time. The radical avant-garde of the revolution saw virtuous superhumans freed of what they saw as the previous strictures and limitations of society, like family, living in a new way, enabled by technology, in mass housing, with canteens instead of kitchens, each performing their allotted task and receiving what was judged to be their needs. A vision that soon switched utopia for dystopia. The Stalinist era returned to the charismatic and emotional heroes in place of the robotic workers of the revolution. Rather than the collective being the new supermen of socialism, it was outstanding individuals, starting, of course, with Lenin and Stalin, and then on down through idealized figures like Stakhanov, the mythically productive worker, who were supermen and models for ordinary citizens to aspire to. These ideas were a strong influence on Gumilev. You might have noticed last episode that while none of those examples of passionary heroes from the past were actually involved in the creation of a new ethnos, they were sometimes people in the vanguard of social change, just like these new Soviet heroes. Another formative influence on both Gumilev and his later followers was the evolving Soviet position on ethnic identity. This is a complex and often inconsistent or even contradictory subject, but difficult to summarize in brief. Before the revolution, Bolsheviks and Marxists more generally had not attached any great value to ethnic identity. In 1916, Lenin said, quote, "The goal of socialism is not only the destruction of the national states into which humanity is divided and isolated, not only rapprochement among the nations, but their complete merger," end quote. Under Stalin, it was held that nations evolved from peoples, which evolved from clans or tribes, a process that could now be controlled by the state. But, like the achievement of communism, the merger of these nations soon became something that, rather than being just on the horizon, was far off, possible only after the global victory of socialism. Only then could a true post-national society emerge. Actually, it was argued, until that happened, the opposite would be true, with national cultures blooming into separate identities. Stalin decided that these should be called socialist nations, which were obviously progressive and qualitatively different from the reactionary and oppressive capitalist nations, this position was a pragmatic one that recognized that the Bolsheviks needed the support of the non-Russian minorities to preserve their rule. Ethnicity became very important in the organization of the early Soviet Union, which had many far-reaching consequences, from the Soviet Union forming as a federation along national lines rather than a unitary state, to the deportations we talked about in the first part of this series. If ethnicity is the defining characteristic of a person, as much as class, then it becomes possible to designate an entire ethnos as enemies of the people, just as classes were designated as enemies of the people. With this essentialist emphasis on ethnicity replacing the previous idea of merging into one new socialist humanity, the Soviet Union adopted Druzhba Narodov, or Friendship of the Peoples, as a model. This finally made ethnic identity key to all Soviet people. Initially, it was presented as if this friendship had originated following the revolution, when it replaced imperial repression. However, by the 1930s, it was being projected back into history and being presented as something as eternal and innate as ethnicity itself. The Soviet historiography shifted. Although the empire remained the prison house of nations, where non-Russian peoples had suffered subjugation and repression, it was now declared that this was the lesser of two evils, and that they would have been even worse off outside of the empire. The extent of the Soviet Union was presented as the positive legacy of the empire, a united territory that was primed for the revolution. It was perhaps inevitable that this process would culminate in the return of ethnic Russian domination. By the late 30s, Russians were being referred to as first among equals. In Stalin's 1945 victory speech, he called Russians the most Soviet and the most revolutionary of nations, the teacher, cultural leader, and all-round elder brother of all the Soviet peoples. Stalin's death brought another shift. Khrushchev did not have much faith in the primacy of ethnic identity and considered it to be generally something reactionary. So merger returned to the agenda. At the 1961 Congress of the Communist Party, it was declared that society had progressed to the creation of a new Sovietsky Narod, or Soviet nation. This nation shared a common homeland, civic identity, values, and economic system. Any individual ethnic identity was now subordinated to the larger, and in the future would be completely superseded by the Soviet identity. In line with this thinking, Khrushchev saw the internal federal borders of the Soviet Union as fading into irrelevance. The abolition of the national republics was discussed, with their replacement with a territorial organization based on economic principles. This was embodied in one decision with consequences that have come down to us today. In 1954, Khrushchev transferred Crimea from Russia to Ukraine, a decision in which, he said, Russia lost nothing and Ukraine gained nothing, since everything remained within the Soviet Union. There was a bit of a shift back under Brezhnev, but the official position remained that, as described in the Great Soviet Encyclopedia, the Soviet people was a new historical, social, and international collectivity of people, possessing a single territory and economy, a culture that is socialist in essence, with a common goal, building communism, and the members of any nation or ethnicity within it consider themselves to be first of all Soviet people. Contrary to the Stalinist era of Druzhba Narodov, this era of the Soviet people was new and created by the revolution. As Brezhnev told the 14th Congress of the Communist Party in 1971, dozens of nations and ethnicities had lived side by side in a single territory in Tsarist Russia, but they did not form a community until they were welded together by Marxist-Leninist ideology. Gumilyov's ideas were taken as a complete rejection of this position. In his view of ethnogenesis and development, there could be no welding together of peoples, and the existence of a Soviet people was impossible. Gumilyov himself was not shy about this. Although his work was focused on ancient history and avoided drawing direct comparisons with contemporary circumstances, he denounced Soviet attempts to build a utopia by forcibly mixing peoples. If everything merges into one, he said, there will be no movement, no cultural development, and life will cease to exist. People of different ethnicities, according to Gumilyov, could not be forced to behave the same. Doing so would require destroying the differences between natural climatic zones, the forest and the steppe, or the mountains and the plains. For him, they should live in peace, but separately. So, Druzhba Narodov, which he called the best policy devised in millennia. Whatever the official policy was, there was no keeping the lid on national consciousness, which increasingly became a centrifugal force in the Soviet Union. Not just among minority peoples, Russian nationalism also began to increase. And despite Gumilyov's sympathy for many of the non-Slavic peoples of the Soviet Union, the Russian nationalists also found a lot that they liked in his work. The new Russian nationalism was quite ideologically diverse, but they were all concerned with maintaining a centralized state in which ethnic Russians had a special primary status as the organizing principle of the multinational state. Combined with a general worldview in which Russia was different from and opposed to its neighbors, especially the capitalist West and China, a clash of civilizations type of worldview. They were generally opposed to the merging of the peoples of the Soviet Union into a single Soviet people. Other nationalisms in the Soviet Union. They were generally opposed to the merging of the peoples of the Soviet Union into a single Soviet people. Other nationalisms in the Soviet Union were also opposed to this, but they were against being subsumed into Russianness, while the Russian nationalist was opposed to being diluted by non-Slavs. Under the influence of Gumilyov's ideas of ethnicity as a natural, biological, rather than social phenomenon, they saw ethnic survival as synonymous with biological survival. Hybridization, as intermarriage between the ethnicities was called, was a concern, as it was for Gumilyov, and falling Russian birth rates were treated as degeneration. With his background in the literary intelligentsia, suffering under Soviet repression and unorthodox thinking, people often thought that Gumilyov would be a liberal, Western-inclined dissident, but this was not the case. In fact, he embraced the nationalists. Gumilyov believed that Soviet society was becoming divided between liberal Democrats and what he called the Black Hundreds Cossacks. The original Black Hundreds were nationalist extremists from the early 20th century who attacked the enemies of autocracy, Russia more generally, and carried out pogroms against the Jews. According to Gumilyov, the liberals were a lost cause. There was nothing that could be discussed with them. He, of course, dismissed them as being under Jewish influence. The Black Hundreds and the Cossacks, on the other hand, represented the historical strength of Russia and its natural role. And nationalists returned the admiration. They liked his support for Russian greatness and uniqueness. his elaborately constructed theories of ethnies as natural and organic phenomena, the biosphere and opposition to mixing was taken as providing a scientific substantiation for ethnocentrism. The supposed natural roles of certain super ethnies and fears about the importance of future survival. What people in the Soviet Union, raised on Marxist-Leninist framings of everything, like to call objective reality. Like more famous dissident works, Gumilev's writings and nationalist commentaries circulated in Samizdat, spreading these ideas further and further. The nationalists even liked the crazy idea of Pashinyanist as the force transforming worthless matter into an organized ethnos, and they adopted the idea of the connection between the natural environment where an ethnos lived and the characteristics of that ethnos. The widespread environmental damage caused by various Soviet industrial and urban projects was seen as further evidence the government was not ruling for the benefit of Russians, and nationalists became environmentalists. They opposed hydroelectric projects, a cellulose plant at Lake Baikal, and a crazy idea that was being promoted in the 70s to reverse the flow of Siberian rivers to deliver water to Central Asia. They did not oppose these projects because of the innate value of the natural environment or ideas about humanity as part of rather than dominating nature. Their objection was that this natural environment was part of Russianness, and therefore its destruction was the destruction of the foundations of the Russian nation. Of course, what nationalists always need is an enemy, and they did not get too creative. The international forces arrayed against Russia and acting through the nefarious agents were the Freemasons and the Jews, sometimes even acting in combination. And that brings us back to the Khazars. The new historiography of the Khazars that we've already mentioned, influenced by Gumilev and the shifting official positions on the national question and Russian history, was culminating in the 60s and 70s in the presentation of the Khazars as a large and powerful empire controlled by a ruthless Jewish elite. This empire was implacably hostile to Slavs, obsessed with making a profit by any means, especially by cooperating with Western agents to enslave Slavs or impose punitive tribute. The rule of the Khazars over the Slavs was dubbed the Khazar yoke, by analogy with the Mongol yoke, but it was claimed to be even worse and more destructive for the Russian people. You might have noticed that I did not mention the Khazar yoke anywhere in discussions of the Khazars and the Rus. That is because, unlike the case of the Mongol yoke, neither the tale of bygone years nor any other contemporary source mentions it. There are traces in the contemporary documents that show the writers remembered that the Rus and the Khazars were rivals and that the Rus had supplanted them as overlords of some of their tributary peoples. But there is no tale of Rus enslavement. To Gumilev and his nationalist followers, this was due to sadness and shame, which led the medieval Russians to conceal their true history. And the nationalists saw Gumilev as the man who had revealed this history, hidden for 1,000 years, and provided a credible scholarly basis for the negative role of Jews in Russian history. Gumilev embraced this too. He produced articles on the Khazars for nationalist journals that were not published until years later because even the nationalists thought they were too anti-Semitic. Gumilev's ideas of the Khazars surviving as Jews and being, with their Western collaborators, the enemies of Russia ever since, were widely accepted and developed. Although Gumilev had focused on the past, on the actual Khazars, however much they were misrepresented, nationalist writers were soon bringing them into the present. For them, the connection between the age of the Khazars and the late Soviet Union was obvious. The direct comparison of the 10th century and the 20th century was natural. The role of non-Slavs, and especially Jews, in the revolution was highlighted. Nationalist writers wrote that the Jews effectively played the same role in revolutionary Russia that they had played in Khazaria, still pursuing their old objective of the destruction of Russian culture. What they wanted was a new Khazaria. From the nationalist underground of the 70s and perestroika, these ideas reached a mass audience in the 1990s. I would not say that they became mainstream in the sense that they were not espoused by the political or cultural establishment, but they reached a point where if you talked about a Khazar conspiracy, people would know what you were talking about and probably had an opinion on it. Anti-Semitic alternative histories became common. Some rewrote the history of Stalin to have him defeating the nefarious plans of the Jewish Bolsheviks. Underground essays were expanded and published as books with titles like A 3,000-Year-Old Mystery, A Contemporary Russian View of Jewish History, or The Truth About the Black Hundreds. Some claimed to continue the work of revealing the true Russian history by claiming that the expansive Russian historiography devoted to conflict with the Tatars was a cover-up for their real conflict, which was with the Jewish Khazars. Alongside those who saw orthodoxy as an integral part of the Russian national identity, there were also neo-pagan nationalists who claimed that the conversion of Rus was itself part of the plot between the Jewish Khazars and their Western allies to subjugate the Rus. These nationalists saw the traditional history as a cover-up. These nationalists also saw traditional history as a cover-up, in this case of the fact that Slavs were the true Aryans and had created the ancient civilizations of Egypt, Sumeria, the Hittites, and the Etruscans. These groups often saw a special significance in Arkaim and the Sintashta being on Russian territory. Although these neo-pagan groups remained marginal, their ideas are well represented in Russian science fiction and fantasy series that have become enormously popular. Scholars studying extremism have found that Russian nationalists were fixated on the Khazars by the late 1990s. They were seen as the first of a series of foreign yokes imposed on the Slavs. Because the Khazars had existed as a state before Rus formed, and because they converted to Judaism, this was translated into an eternal Jewish enmity from the very beginning of Russian history. Life in the Soviet Union was characterized by the use of euphemisms to avoid, or at least give the appearance of avoiding, things that were forbidden. This was true of nationalist movements as much as other dissidents, and for Russian nationalists, Khazar became their favorite euphemism to hide their anti-Semitic ideas. Rather than talking about Jewish infiltration of the Soviet government or shadowy Jewish figures controlling everything from the background, they would talk about Khazar expansionism or Khazar enslavement. The usual anti-Semite excuses were also made. They did not oppose the Jews, they would say, only the harmful Jews, the ones trying to rule the world, or international Zionism, or the Ashkenazi, who, as we've already heard, they claimed descended from the Khazars and were not, therefore, true Jews. Along with the Khazars, the nationalists also frequently used the ethnic chimera, demonstrating Gumilev's role in popularizing the term. Gumilev's descriptions of Jewish Khazars as parasites and tumors echoes another influence on the nationalists. Hitler, who said that, quote, the Jew was never a nomad, but always and always a parasite in the body of other peoples, end quote. following their understanding of Gumilyov, they saw ethnicity as the essential and archetypal inheritance from prehistoric ancestors, the source of cultural distinctions that could never be crossed over. As the Russian people were the same from time immemorial, their great enemy was likewise. This was said openly. As prominent nationalist author Vadim Kozhinov wrote, Khazaria was the permanent, persistent, and perfidious enemy of Rus. Some nationalists called communism an anti-system, meaning that it too was a chimera, caused by a clash between the Russians and Jews. The revolution was part of the world Zionist plot. According to some nationalists, the word Haber meant both the segment of Jewish society that was trying to dominate the world, and comrade, proving a link between the Khazars and the Bolsheviks. So the nationalist worldview explained the whole of Russian history in terms of a never-ending struggle against the Jewish-created chimera, forever trying to subjugate Russia. This is often combined with the view that the Turkic origins of the Khazars meant that not only were they cunning Jews, they were also savage Asiatics, leading to much lamenting of Russians' underappreciated role in defending Europe from their deprecations. A Russian emigre to the United States, Vladimir Ushkuynek, expanded the idea still further. Not only were the Jews of Eastern Europe Khazars, but they still retained their traditional Khazar dual kingship. Lazar Kaganovich, a prominent Jewish Bolshevik, thus became the Kagan who Stalin served as Beg. Others took this up. After all, it was right there in Kaganovich's name. Kagan. Talk about hiding in plain sight. The Khazar myth had several characteristics that made it attractive and useful to Russian nationalists. The Khazars had made the Eastern Slavs pay tribute and sold them into slavery for great profit. So they could be accused of continuing to want to rule and enslave Slavs. The role of Jews in Khazaria meant that Khazars could be charged with the usual anti-Semitic stereotypes of greed and cupidity. The Khazar influence on the formation of Rus could be blamed for perceived negative aspects of the Russian character, such as unusual cruelty. The Jewish conversion of the Khazar ruling class was a clear example of their successful attempt to seize power, which they were still doing elsewhere. For Orthodox nationalists, the Khazarian rabbi participating in the dispute where Vladimir chose the religion of Rus was an example of the Jews attempting to spiritually dominate Rus. For the neo-pagans, the supposed Jewish origin of Christianity meant that the Khazars were behind the conversion of Rus. Tying the Khazars to Eastern European Jewish communities established a continuum from the Khanate to modern times, in which the Khazars preserved Jewish behavior and racial traits, as well as the desire to revenge themselves for Sviatoslav's destruction of Khazaria. The dual kingship of the Khazars could be linked to other regimes, where a Jewish puppet master could be alleged to hide behind a Russian public ruler. Finally, the Khazars could also be tied into the classic themes of Jewish world domination, which also elevated Russia's role from mere self-preservation to defending the whole of world civilization from evil, which fitted in well with other messianic ideas about Russia. Every flavor of nationalist could find something to suit whatever it was that they were most obsessed about. Orthodoxy, the yellow peril, or Russia's imperial mission of salvation. So the myth that Jewish Khazars were out there battling to subjugate Russia and establish a new Khazaria became well established in national discourse. But what and where the new Khazaria is has varied. First, it was the USSR, where supposedly Russians suffered at the hands of other nationalities, and the entire project of creating the Soviet identity was intended specifically to destroy the Russian national consciousness. Some writers like to call this a spiritual Khazar yoke. In the 1990s, Russia became the new Khazaria. Some of those who had called the Soviet Union the new Khazaria even went so far as to call Russia the third Khazaria. Nationalists worked themselves into paroxysms over Jewish oligarchs. During the Semibankishchina, or the time of the seven bankers, a play on the name for a historical episode where seven boyars had governed Russia. Of the seven banker oligarchs who had engineered the re-election of and were allegedly controlling Yeltsin, Boris Berezovsky, Mikhail Friedman, and Vladimir Gusinsky were Jewish, and Mikhail Khodorkovsky's father was Jewish. Berezovsky in particular became a lightning rod for anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists. The rise of Vladimir Putin caused something of a split in nationalist circles. Some threw in their lot with Putin straight away, sure that he would eventually come out on their side, even though he gave them thin gruel in the early years. Alexander Prokhanov, editor of popular nationalist newspaper Zavtra and author of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion-derived novel Mr. Hexagen, which somehow won the National Bestseller Award in 2003, called Putin Russia's champion against the Khazars. From being an anti-Semitic pariah in the Yeltsin years, with his paper only sold by shabby-looking old men outside the metro, he became a regular talking head on Russian national TV channels in the Putin era. Others were not so easily seduced, arguing instead that Putin was actually the leader of the Khazars, laying the groundwork for the collapse of Israel when all the Jews would move to Russia and create new Khazaria. When Putin made his return to the presidency in 2012, this began to change and the conspiracists began talking about a new target for plotters planning the new Khazaria. This time, Ukraine. As in Russia, Jewish Ukrainian oligarchs were allegedly working in the interests of Israel, the Freemasons, and the West more generally. Igor Kolomoisky, a leading oligarch who was once governor of Dnipropetrovsk region, allegedly backed Zelensky's move into politics and has now had his citizenship revoked, was given a leading role in these theories. When the Maidan protests kicked off, they were immediately ascribed to Zionist Khazars attempting to start a civil war among Russians. Anyone following the news should be caught up by now that Russian nationalists do not regard Ukraine as a legitimate country or Ukrainians as a separate people. So in presenting the new government following the Revolution of Dignity as a Khazar junta, they were continuing the line of Khazaria's eternal battle against Russia, and therefore Khazar Ukraine is an existential threat to Russia. When Russian forces masquerading as separatists started fighting in eastern Ukraine, some nationalists claimed that Putin was again acting in the interests of a Zionist Khazar plot by creating a destructive civil war between Russian brothers that would once again pave the way for a creation of a new Khazaria in place of Ukraine. According to Schlingermann, the idea of Ukraine as the new Khazaria became almost universal in Russian nationalist publications in 2012 to 2014, but then disappeared almost overnight in 2015, suggesting that rather than being an organic outgrowth of the conspiracies already floating around Russia for decades, it was actually something that was organized and intentionally promoted by someone in the Russian state apparatus. However, opinion polling in Russia showed that the public wasn't buying the idea that Ukraine had been taken over by Jewish Khazars trying to create a Nazi regime opposed to Russia, so the idea was quietly dropped. But disappearing from nationalist organizations, did not mean that it disappeared altogether. Any number of YouTube videos about Khazars attempting to destroy Russia continue to appear, and of course they have resurrected the Ukrainian theme since the full-scale invasion began. Best-selling books continue to be written, including by people teaching at Moscow State University and military academies, and speakers present Jewish Khazar conspiracy theories through Russian Orthodox Church media and events. You might wonder why I've taken the time to digress into this subject so far away from 10th century Rus. Surely Jewish plots to rule the world are the marginal fantasies of fringe lunatics. Indeed, I would hardly call claims that Kolomoisky was working to build a new Khazaria in Ukraine to be populated by moving the population of Israel mainstream. But some or parts of the ideas discussed across these three episodes have indeed become mainstream. The idea that today's Jews are not true, real Jews, but only Khazars who have adopted Judaism has become a core element of Russian anti-Semitism. Putin even stated his belief that modern Jews, quote, have nothing genetically to do with the genuine Jewish ethnos. At a meeting with cultural industry representatives at the Kremlin in 2019. It has become mainstream to think of ethnicity as an immutable and essential characteristic. In this worldview, it's not only absurd to think of people who may have had some Russian heritage acquiring a Ukrainian identity, it's unnatural, even evil. Gumilyovin ideas, like the superethnos and Pashinyanist, have become mainstream. They are routinely heard in the Russian national media. As a superethnos, Russia is capable of absorbing more ethnies. Maybe it even should. The idea of any of the other peoples of Russia, Tatars, Buryats, Sakha, or whoever, retaining their own identity rather than embracing being Ruski, is simply laughed at as if it was something ridiculous on its face. Driven by its passionary force, Russian attempts to dominate their neighbours and imperial wars of conquest cannot be judged in terms of right and wrong. They are merely the normal course of ethnic development driven by natural forces. The death and destruction of other cultures and the environment are, as Gumilyov said, a shame, but what can you do? Perhaps more importantly for today's Russia, the Khazar myth is part of a larger myth of Russian victimhood, of a world that has been continually trying to destroy Russia since its earliest days, that underpins so much of what is wrong with Russia and obstructs any attempts to assess and come to terms with its past. In this worldview, Russia is never the perpetrator. Wars are always imposed on it by outside forces, never its own choices, and the great atrocities in its history are put down to either outsiders working to destroy Russia, or dismissed as unfortunate mistakes that got a bit out of hand. And while there may be vigorous debate among scholars and experts as to how much of Russian society supports the war on Ukraine, there can be no doubt that the number of them who believe that Ukraine is now ruled by a junta that simultaneously manages to be both Nazi and Jewish, is far greater than the 1-2% found in polling 10 years ago. One of the leading experts on Khazars, whose name you will have heard several times back in the episodes on Khazaria, Peter Golden, said, quote, "Any presentation of the achievements of Khazar studies is necessarily idiosyncratic, inevitably reflecting personal interests, languages, political and cultural education, and so on." End quote. And he went on to hope that Khazar studies would be less subject to the ideological pressure of political currents in the 21st century as totalitarian regimes fade away. Sadly, totalitarian regimes seem to be fading back in. As I was writing this episode, Vladimir Putin was again telling the world that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is a Nazi-supporting disgrace to Jews. I've been a bit remiss about writing the accompanying blog posts, but they will be back with this episode, and as this ends our coverage of the Khazars, there will be a list of sources that I've used and some suggestions for anyone wanting to do some further reading, which I'll also add to the resources page. Next episode, we return to Rus to see how Sviatoslav's sons deal with the issue of succession. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.